Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Welcome to the Daily Jungle. Happy Podcast Tuesday and happy Fat Tuesday, clones. You handled the second part of that about as well as I thought you would. There was a mini border skirmish that broke out as Team Canada called all of America, well, fat. Big show, though, today. SoCal native Chloe Kim is absolutely owning the Olympics. It happened over the weekend, but I could not miss the Cavs going into the Garden and ruining Paul Pierce's big night. And where were you when Bucknell ran down Colgate? I'll tell you where I was, watching on CBS Sports Network. MLB analyst John Smoltz was back in the jungle. Great conversation also with Damian Lillard. And Xavier guard Trayvon Blewett joined me in the middle of another big season for Xavier and Chris Mack. Let's get it. The Daily Jungle starts right now. I am starting with the Olympics. We are a few days now into the Winter Olympics. And let me ask you this. What has been your favorite moment so far? What has been your favorite moment so far? Chris Masder winning the first medal for America in singles luge. Good moment. Maybe it was 17-year-old Red Garrard oversleeping after binging Brooklyn Nine-Nine on Netflix and then rolling out and winning gold in the slopestyle. I know my fam loved that. Love that guy. Maybe it was Adam Rippon killing it on the ice, then on Twitter and declaring, quote, "There are so many emotions when I step on the ice. I want to represent my country to the best of my abilities. I want to make Reese Witherspoon proud." End quote. It's a good line. Really good line. All those things are awesome. I was into all of that. But they were just lapped last night by a 17-year-old born in Long Beach, raised in Torrance, right here in SoCal, America. Meet Chloe Kim. And if you have not already met her, there is really nobody quite like her. A prodigy who learned to board as a four-year-old in the local mountains here in California. She made the Olympic team as a 13-year-old, but by rule was too young to participate. And since then, there has been nothing but hype and expectation. And as you know, almost nothing ever lives up to ridiculous hype and expectation. However, she murdered both in ripping the gold. And honestly, she could not be any cooler or any more likable either. But when she straps a board to her feet and drops into the half pipe, she is a killer. And when she's on Twitter, she might be even better. So if you've been paying attention to the buildup, you knew Chloe Kim was coming. That was not some lucky win. That was not some overnight success. The hype had been building because she's awesome, both on and off the half pipe. As an example, check out this combination of tweets from earlier in the week. She jumps on Twitter and says, quote, "I'm so nervous." I mean, it's cool, right? It's charming. What athlete, before any major event, jumps on Twitter and says, "I'm so nervous"? That in and of itself was good, but then she chased it with, and I quote, "Oh, and I also had two churros today, and they were pretty bomb. So if you ever get nervous, go eat a churro." Hell yes. Words to live by. So that took the pre-Olympics hype to a whole new level. Most others in her position are privately gripping, trying to spin the clock, trying to get to the day that they've spent their entire lives dreaming of and working for. In short, freaking out. And she's tweeting about smashing churros. But as always, very few things ever live up to the hype. And that hype went to another level when she tweeted between qualifying runs. All right, that's something else. Anybody else, if you tweet during a game, or you tweet during halftime, or you tweet during a timeout, it's not a good look. She tweets in between qualifying runs that she could, quote, "be down for some ice cream right now." When somebody replied to her saying, "Aren't you competing right now?" And again, we're not talking about some spring game. We're not talking about some meaningless regular season game. We are talking about the Olympics. Quote, "Aren't you competing right now?" She responded with yes. And when the NBC Olympics account put up a poll asking what kind of ice cream she should get, she herself jumped in with, "Cookies and cream is some good stuff. If anyone can get some to the village, that'd be dope." End quote. Man, that tweet is dope. And what came afterwards in the final was even better than the cookies and cream. Because on her very first of three runs, she scores a 9-3 or 93-75. None of the other 11 finalists could match that. That was a legendary run, and it came right after a legendary tweet. She tweeted, quote, and again, this is all in the middle of the competition. When I finished my breakfast sandwich, but my stubborn self decided not to, or wish I had, my stubborn self decided not to, and now I'm getting hangry. Hangry. So what I'm getting at is this. The old rap about Twitter was that it was just people tweeting about what they had for breakfast. This is somebody tweeting about what they had for breakfast between runs in the Olympic finals. It's incredible. First off, having her phone with her during the Olympic finals is pretty amazing. Thumbing out that tweet is even better. That'd be like LeBron hitting an Instagram post during a timeout and then dropping 50 on the Celtics. And according, you want to talk about somebody stepping up their Twitter game. According to the official Twitter data account, when at Chloe Kim Snow dropped into the half pipe, she had 15,000 followers. By the time she finished her run, she had tweeted about her sandwiches and earned a gold medal. She had over 100,000 new followers, and that number's still much higher. And then her day only got better because nobody caught her score from the first run. She had the gold medal in the bag before her final run. She could have just done the highest profile heel slide ever and still would have been on top of the podium. But instead, she lets it rip and nails not one, but two 1080s and scores a 98.75. And as she said, quote, I knew that if I went home with the gold medal, knowing I could do better, I wasn't going to be satisfied, end quote. That's why she's a legend. That's what makes the Olympics special. The Olympics are like this. There's that combination of people who grind away in anonymity for years in sports that the general public doesn't really pay attention to or really care. Folks for whom just reaching the Olympics is winning a medal. But then you've got the breakout stars. Then you've got athletes like Chloe Kim who transcend their sport because of their ability and their personality. So go ahead, put her on a Wheaties box, put her on an ice cream container, get her a breakfast sandwich box. I mean, why she doesn't already have her own reality show, I have no idea. Because she is a blast. And we could all use a little more of a star who's tweeting about breakfast sandos and being hangry in the biggest competition of her life. I think she's great. I love her. I think she's amazing. She's got crazy killer it. As always, it's hard to explain what it is, but you know it when you see it, and she's got a crazy amount of it. So much so that I was more than happy to lead this show at the Olympics and, in fact, was eager to lead the show at the Olympics. Chloe Kim rules. What an amazing story that is. And there's so much more to that story, too. As a four-year-old, she learned to board at Mountain High? Here in SoCal? It's incredible. And we are joined right now by John Smoltz. John, great to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you, John. All right, I'm going to talk to you about the documentary. Let me first ask you, with pitchers and catchers reporting, the Astros won the World Series last year. You know they find themselves in a position of coming to camp as the defending champs. You know, in terms of the documentary, we'll hit that in a minute. But when you guys were in the middle of your run of dominance and coming off that World Series win, was there a different feel in spring training the year after a World Series win?
Yeah, you know, for us, it was a long time coming, meaning we had been there so close so many times and didn't come up, you know, we're coming up short. So when we won the World Series, it shifted from, oh, what a relief, because, you know, people are starting to compare us with teams of past who have been there and didn't get it done, to we had a chance to run the table a couple times. And certainly in 96, that didn't disappoint. We were on our way. When we got down 3-1 to St. Louis, went on that run of 5 straight games where we just crushed our next 5 games, no one would have dreamt we were going to lose. No one was going to dream we were going to lose the next 4 games to the New York Yankees and ultimately not win that World Series. That was the most amazing turnaround. That definitely changed the destiny of our organization. I think we end up doing what the Yankees do, and they win 4 out of 5, and we didn't win another one. So coming into that spring training, we felt we were pretty good. We thought we could win two in a row, and we certainly were two games away from doing that.
Clones, can I borrow a second so I can talk with you about Stamps.com? It goes without saying that the U.S. Postal Service is an important tool for any business reaching every household every single day. Now, Stamps.com is the easiest way to access all the amazing services of the post office. Stamps.com never closes. You can print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7. You can print postage for any mail class right from your own computer, with the exact amount of postage every single time, so you never underpay or overpay. And Stamps.com saves you time and money, which you can use to grow your business. I love Stamps.com, and the reason I use Stamps.com is because it is convenient, it is easy, it is reliable, it is so efficient, it saves me so much time. I love this product. And right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. So go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Jungle. To get this deal, go to Stamps.com and enter the code name Jungle. I love this product. I know you will too. That's Stamps.com. Now it's back to our Daily Jungle. John Smoltz joining us. I'm going to go back to that in 1 minute. You know, you mentioned the Yankees. They had Giancarlo Stanton in the offseason. Obviously, that generates an enormous amount of buzz. Are they the team to beat in the American League, or is it still the Astros?
I think it's still the Astros. As much as the Yankees have improved themselves, they still have a little bit of the starting rotation question marks, and I think that's got to be figured out with health. And their offense speaks for itself. Look, their offense was good last year. It just got better, but it also has a lot of strikeouts in it. And with the right-handed pitching that's in the league, there's a lot of right-handed power guys, and it's not like they're not there isn't holes, but they've given themselves a great opportunity to win baseball games via their offense. You know, outscore guys, outscore teams at times, and then at the same time win games with their bullpen, and that's their bullpen's still pretty good.
Talking to John Smoltz, you know, John, there's the challenge of staying on top, and then there's the challenge of getting back to the World Series after losing it. I mean, I can hear it in your voice. You still haven't forgotten about that. How long do you think last year's World Series is going to linger with the Dodgers?
The Dodgers are approached. They have been, you know, they're the kind of forgotten pressure point. What I mean by that is they haven't won in a long time, but the Cubs 2 years ago broke a streak. The Astros had broke a streak, so the pressure's kind of off them until we play this season, and then it's going to be all focusing on, really, the Dodgers and the expectation. And that pressure, I'm telling you, is so internal and great. Now, everyone will be able to deflect it, but I can just tell you for ourselves, going into 95, the guys that have been there a while, like myself, we felt the pressure of, we better win one soon. And I think it's natural to think that way when you have the expectations that the Dodgers do and the payroll and the star power. So I think when you think about how they're built to win a World Series championship. And getting that close last year and Game 7 at home will certainly make that pressure intensify.
John Smoltz, my guest. There's an MLB Network documentary called Atlanta Rules, the story of the 90s Braves. More on that in 1 minute. John, just one more thought before we get to the documentary. I just want to ask you about Yu Darvish. He signs with the Cubs. He obviously had a rough World Series. What do you make of that fit with Chicago?
I think it's a great fit, and I'll tell you why. Because Chicago is primed. What they've done is they've gone out and they have established a young core of position players. They did not go in the route of young dynamic arms, right? So they have to buy their arms or trade for their arms. So in a time frame that they have these fantastic position players, their window in the next 4 years has to be centered around their winning opportunity. And so much like signing Lester, much like trading for Hendricks, and much to the degree of this signing, this puts them in a nice spot, the leg up. The first thing you got to do is win your division or get in the playoffs. That's the first thing you got to do. And so by creating a team in the offseason, giving your team the best chance to do that, the Cubs are still the favorites in the Central.
John Smoltz, my guest. You know, John, in terms of the documentary, which is going to air tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern, you know, I think it's pretty easy to forget that before you went on that great, great run, this was a team that did certainly struggle before those great Braves teams. What, and you made your debut in 1988. What were the first years like?
You know, I tell people all the time, it was as brutal as it gets. First, I get traded from the Detroit Tigers to the Atlanta Braves. I go to one of the worst AAA teams in the history, and I could see it was an older team waiting for some young players. We're like 35 games out of first, something crazy. And then I could see what was below me. But then I get to the big leagues, and we lose 100 games in 88, 89, and 90, and I'm going, I'm never going to win. There's just no way I'm going to win. I mean, what does winning even look like? And then all of a sudden, you see some of this younger talent that the minor leagues had, and this slowly but surely, they integrated one guy and then a next guy. And before you know it, we were in a situation where we could make necessary changes, and the next thing you know, we've added Belliard, Bream, and Terry Pendleton, two defensive guys that were as good as it gets, and a leadership of these guys where they had been from winning organizations, and they taught us the ropes. It was fantastic. And that gave us hope. In 91, we went right away from the second half, went on this nice little run, and got in the playoffs, of course, historic games against Minnesota. But it was that leadership that allowed us to put us in position to be successful, and that defense that we were so desperately needing, you know, with the young pitching that was coming. So it was pretty well documented that Terry and Sid and even Belliard were huge for our development.
God, Pendleton especially too, right? I remember when he got there in 1991, and he had said to one of the beat reporters that this team will be contending. And the reporter said, quote, "You do realize this is the Atlanta Braves and not the St. Louis Cardinals, right?" I mean, you talk about what this guy did for you in terms of leadership, what he did with his glove, his timely hitting. I mean, how strong a presence was Pendleton right when he walked in that clubhouse?
He was huge, because in a clubhouse, which is not measured today and hard to put numbers to, he'd take one guy or two guys on the side and said, "We don't do that here. This is not how you become a big leaguer." You know, he had the full backing of the manager and Bobby Cox, and let Terry Pendleton and Sid Bream run the clubhouse and make sure that these young, talented players had an opportunity to know and to see firsthand that your words match, your action matches your words. And I'm telling you, it was priceless for us. It was almost like a gift. Like, all the things that we wondered if we'd ever win again were coming right in our lap from guys who came from other teams, allowing us to benefit from that. And without it, I don't think there's any chance. You know, we had guys like veterans, Charlie Liebrandt, helping the young pitchers, and even in a way where no one maybe pitched like him, but he gave us, we had every corner covered in a way that basically gave us a chance to develop the young farm system that Bobby Cox had built up. And then John Scherholz came over and added some pieces and orchestrated this incredible run that we say, without a doubt, every player knows we should have won multiple championships. It was on us. We didn't get it done. And that's the one thing that when we look back, we realize no one in the history of the game will ever do what we did. But we definitely knew we should have won. We should have won more championships.
Yeah, John, that's so interesting. I mean, is that the takeaway? If I were to say to you, from 1991, you went on to win 14 straight division titles. 14 straight. So when you look back on that era, what then do you think of first, and what do you remember the most?
I remember in the first six of them, we were definitely probably the best team, right? But after that, there's no doubt, no player's ever going to go, "Hey, this team's better than us." We won despite, we made transitions. We went through, you know, when I went to the bullpen, our rotation was different. We won despite having lost some guys to injuries or certain things. We won and weren't as good, but got to the playoffs because of basically Bobby Cox. So when I think of that run, I'm reminded that, you know, the core stayed together. We had built around starting pitching, and the young player, one player after another, would get added to this roster. You think about Chipper Jones, and he gets in his first year, win a World Series. Then we added, you know, earlier to that, we added Avery. Then we added Andrew Jones. And then we added, you know, David Justice. All the different pieces that it wasn't this bought team. It was a developed team that homegrown guys got to be part of the nucleus of winning, and that was special.
That's bringing me back, right? Andrew Jones coming up like at 19. Avery was just filthy when he was 20 and totally fearless. And then you got Chipper Jones, who's now the sixth member of the organization from that era to be voted into the Hall of Fame. So what do you remember about the first time you saw him play? And then what was your reaction when you heard that he's a member of the Hall of Fame too?
Yeah, that was a no-brainer after I got to play with him for 15 years. Seeing him early on, and people forget, like, he blew out his knee in spring training. And so he blows out his ACL, and here's a young number one pick, you know, shortstop, learning to play third, wiry kid that you can see the bat, the ball jumps off his bat. To have him come back from that knee injury and then develop into the one of the greatest switch-hitting pitchers in, you know, in the history of the game, it was impressive to watch. And you knew he was special. And just like you knew Andrew Jones was special. I mean, first two swings in the World Series were home runs. He had just this gift of a presence of a young 19-year-old. Avery, to me, was Clayton Kershaw before Clayton Kershaw became Clayton Kershaw. And I'm telling you, he was that good. And then an injury set him back. So we had the time of our lives in the run that we went on, knowing that it was going to last for a while, never thinking 17 years. But at the same time, when you keep those core guys together and you have your manager the entire time in that run, it definitely spells success.
Hey, John, one last thing. This is really funny to me since, I mean, you know the guy that I'm going to mention, and now that you're on the media side, I think you can relate to this even more. But back in the day, when you played, you always came on the show and you were so great to talk to. Tom Glavine always came on the show. He was so great to talk to. But Maddox was the guy that you always wanted to talk to because he would never talk, right?
Yeah.
And for some reason, John, he agreed to an interview with Tom Glavine on a TV show that I did. But only if Glavine did it, and he only said that we could have 9 minutes or 11 minutes. It was some random number. We're halfway through the interview, and I'm saving my best question for Maddox, and I have this whole setup, and I can't see the monitor, John. I'm just asking the question just, you know, blindly. And at the end of the question, Glavine says, Jim, I'm going to pick you up on that one. Maddox left, but I'll answer it. When he said 9 minutes, John, he meant 9 minutes. He got up and walked out in the middle of the interview. It was like, I couldn't even be mad. It was so funny. It was such an amazing Maddox thing to do, and I never spoke to him ever again.
He was the most calculated. Look, everything what Greg did, he was a great teammate, very humble and unassuming in a way where he came across like a bad interview on purpose.
Sure.
I think he did everything he could to stay away from, you know, he could walk down the street, no one's going to know who he is. Now, how many superstars and Hall of Famers could you say that about? It was intentional with him. And we ended up doing more interviews about Greg Maddox than Greg Maddox did about himself. And so to your point, he just found a way to make sure that he was going to control the environment and make sure that it didn't come across of anything other than aw shucks. And I think that's just the way he was. We understood it. We watch him give an interview and go, that's like the worst interview you can give. And then those guys would stop doing interviews and they'd come to us and ask us questions about Greg Maddox.
Now, again, it might be Tuesday, but you best believe that I'm going to double back to Sunday for a second. You think I'm going to let an all-out Cavs wax job of the Celtics just bleed out on the cutting room floor because I was in my basement yesterday? Hell freaking no. Not when the Cavs absolutely detonated their team an hour before the trade deadline last week, and then they roll the new dudes right through Beantown 2 days later, and they straight cold-cocked Boston. Tell me you weren't surprised that the rebooted Cavs mopped the Celtics by 22. And I'll tell you, you are a liar. You didn't see that coming. Nobody saw that coming. No one saw George Hill, Larry Nance Jr., Jordan Clarkson, and Rodney Hood all combine to pump in 49 points their very first night on the floor with LeBron. But it happened. And I'll tell you something else that happened. The Cavs held an opponent under triple digits for only the third time since Christmas. So again, I said it on Friday. I said they were better. I already knew they were better. Without even seeing them on the floor, I knew they were better. I didn't know how much better, but I did know this. They were going to be much better defensively because any defense would have been better than the defense the Cavs were playing because they haven't played defense all year long. And just being in the neighborhood of decent on that side of the ball was going to be a monumental upgrade. And that's where they're living now. The Undefeated dropped an article yesterday that detailed some game moments, or some moments after that game on Sunday. Apparently, GM Coby Altman was so jacked up, he waited outside the locker room to dap up his new squad after they walked off the floor. And the article also has J.R. Smith yelling, "We got a bleeping squad now." Dude, by the way, we met the dude behind that, Adam Hawk. So, dude, you, this predates you. Go ahead. Go to the camera. Put your cans on. Let's see what horrible shirt you're wearing. Wait, I'm not even going to look. If you're watching on TV right now, my eyes are closed. I predict Hawk buttoned it all the way up. Let's see. Yes, of course. Well, anyway, I'm not going to ask you why you do that. Our man's name was Ford, right?
Ford, yeah.
Ford, and Ford is CBS based.
Yes, he is.
Ford was the one who composed that song.
Yeah.
We had never met the guy behind the song.
Right, and then we met him in the Mall of America green room right behind the food court in Minnesota. It was great.
And I tried to explain to him, dude, you have no idea. Keep that up, Albie. You have no idea how awesome that song is and what that's meant to us and how much mileage we've gotten out of that and what kind of content that's been. I mean, bro, that's genius. That's brilliant. Did you know about that, Hawk, before you got here?
No.
That song?
I don't even know what this song is. It's J.R. Smith singing.
Anyway, you're dismissed, Hawk.
Thank you.
Sorry I brought it up. I don't even know what this song is. What this song is incredible. What I just did by bringing Hawk onto the program was a poor choice by me. Come on, Pigeon, you're better than that. You were there when we had the conversation with this guy. What do you mean you don't know what this is? So wrong, Hawk, man. You're all, I'm going to have Ford, and your Ford said to me, he goes, "Hey, you know, if you guys ever have an idea for something and you want me to make or compose something else, I might be up for that. If you have the right idea, just give me some heads up." I said, "Ford, absolutely. It's going to be hard to top that. You might want to walk off on that. But if I get an idea, I definitely will get that to you." And it just came to me. Why don't you write a song about how wrong Hawk is? J.R. Swish is so right. And now you can write about how wrong Hawk is. Anyway, Swish. Swish joyfully dropping F-bombs and saying, "We got a bleeping squad now." That might have been the highlight of the night. The low light of the night, though, had to be the truth. Paul Pierce, all blazered up, waiting to hang his gamer in the rafters as his former team got curb stomped in front of 20,000 totally disengaged fans. Or at least what was left of the 20,000 totally disengaged fans. Now, you remember about a month back, this guy did not want to share a single second of his night with Isaiah Thomas. I'm pretty sure my man would have given the entire ceremony to IT after the Celtics laid down on his night and sucked all the air right out of that joint. I mean, did you see this guy's face? Looked like Laramie Tunsil on draft night. One of the best nights of his life had just turned into one of the worst nights of his life. And maybe you start to wonder if karma took an enormous bite out of this guy for using up 40 minutes on the blower to make sure that Danny Ainge did not allow IT a video tribute on the very same night. Remember that whole thing? But the better question probably is not about karma. The better question is, who the hell scheduled the jersey retirement for after the game? I mean, how many different ways have the Celtics screwed this thing up from the very jump? And then when they finally figure it out, and he's going to get his own night, and IT is not only off the Cavs, he's out of the conference altogether, and they finally get it, and they think they have it, they schedule it for after the game. Who does that? And against the Cavs of all teams. You know, maybe the Suns, if they're rolling through town. Maybe you bank a win, and then you have the ceremony after the game. But the Cavs, a team that you're dealing with in the East, a motivated team. The Cavs. Yeah, great idea. The entire fourth quarter was garbage time.
Garbage.
And you were on the wrong side of it. P, People were leaving the building. They were so disgusted by the effort, they couldn't even stay and wait through it to honor their guy, arguably the greatest Celtic of them all, not named Bill Russell, or Bob Cousy, or John Havlicek, or JoJo White. Well, maybe above that. You see me working. They couldn't even wait. People left the building. And the truth just sat there watching fans hit the exits, wondering why the hell they didn't just hang his shirt at halftime when it was still a 12-point game. Worst planning ever. Hey, I'd say you'll get him next time, Truth. You'll get him next time. But there isn't going to be a next time. That was a once-in-a-career moment, totally ruined, and again, by awful planning. I mean, Danny Ainge, I got to admit, this guy's a genius. You know, I was wrong when I said they should have made a move. They should have made a move. This guy stole Kyrie Irving. I mean, Danny Ainge is unbelievable. And I literally take back virtually almost anything. And mostly I've been positive about Danny Ainge's whole career. I was critical before a trade deadline, and he was right and I was wrong. But somebody's asleep at the wheel here. How do you plan that thing after a game? Hey, but again, hey, you know me. I'm all about keeping it positive. I'm all about seeing everything as the glass is half full, not half empty. At least there wasn't a video tribute to IT. Got that going for you, Truth. At least it was all your night. IT wasn't even in the building because he doesn't play for the Cavs anymore. Bad night all the way around. And in terms of where that leaves the two of these teams, from a basketball standpoint, I get it. It's only one game. It's only one game. Then again, maybe it's not only one game. Boston does not have any reinforcements coming. Cleveland now has theirs. And most importantly, LeBron is rejuvenated. LeBron is re-energized. And after they carved out some of that cancer from that locker room and they dumped a bunch of their dead weight, as I said last week, LeBron no longer hates coming to work. And since he no longer hates coming to work, the rest of us no longer hate watching them work. They are definitely better. Now it's just a question of how much better. They were dead in the water a week ago, and now they look like they at least have a run in them, especially in the East. At least LeBron will have one last run in him before he bounces once again. So this thing's getting interesting all of a sudden. Except not for the truth. People leaving before it went up in the rafters. Let's do this thing after the game. If you're going to do that after the game, why don't you pick a game you know you're going to win? And then everybody can have a great time. Damian Lillard is my guest. Damian, so good to have you back. What's up? How are you?
I'm doing great, man. I appreciate you having me again.
Damian, I appreciate you all the time. Really good to have you back. Now, you're coming off a tough loss to Utah last night. It did end a 9-game home winning streak. So how quickly do you go about putting that in the rearview mirror and getting ready to face Golden State tomorrow night?
I mean, well, obviously having a team like Golden State coming in, you got to have your mind right for them. It's our last game before the break. And we want to get this win. You know, we want to go into this break strong. And that's a tough game to finish it with. But if we're still thinking about the Utah game and what we could have did better, how we lost the game, you know, that's a setup for going into this one and getting ran at the gym. So we got to go into this game excited and ready to go into the break with a win.
Damian Lillard joining us. I mentioned the 50 that you had against the Kings on Friday night. The fourth time you've done that in your career, and you didn't even play the fourth quarter because the team had such a big lead. I mean, on a night like that, before the game, do you know that you're about to do something special, or does something like that only unfold naturally, and you never really know?
I think it unfolds naturally. I think for guys who play a lot of minutes and get a lot of opportunity, it's natural for us to, you know, maybe have nights where we know from the start that we're going to come out more aggressive and try to impose our will on the game, and that's how I felt before the game. We was on a back-to-back. We had a tough game the night before against Charlotte at home, and it was a setup for us to, you know, come playing against a team that had 3 days off. They was fresh on their home court, and I knew that I was going to need to come out and be aggressive and be a force. So that was on my mind, but, you know, I couldn't have predicted that I was going to the fourth quarter with 50 points.
You know, I want to ask you about that because you didn't play that fourth quarter. But before we get there, I mean, they're scoring 50 in 29 minutes, and then they're scoring 50 in 29 minutes with your grandmother in the building. How much more did it mean to you to have that game with her there?
it meant a lot. Not just only having my grandmother there, but she hasn't been to a game in 3 years. The last game, she used to come to every game, and then like 3 years ago at Golden State, I was looking for her after the game, and she wasn't there. And when I came out, everybody in my family was looking all sad and stuff and bothered. And my mom pulled me to the side and told me that she had been diagnosed with breast cancer. And she had been fighting that for a long time. So it was just great to see her back out and about and healthy and moving around. And at the game where I just happened to have 50 and three quarters. So it was a great accomplishment, but it was an even better feeling to see her there because she hadn't been in so long.
That is great. Damian Lillard's my guest. So you have a career high 59. A lot of guys in your position sitting on 50 at the end of the third quarter would be looking to get back in there and snap that record and chase a new number. But you said after the game, quote, "I'd rather have 50 in 29 minutes with some character than go out there and chase 60," end quote. Really interesting. Lay that out for me. What do you mean by that?
I meant, you know, we was up by 20 points and – you know, obviously, I could go out there and, you know, probably get 60 or more. But that wasn't what was necessary. You know, at that point, I feel like I would have been almost showing up the opponent. You know, when the game is in hand, it's not really necessary for me to be on the court. So I felt like, you know, I have plenty of opportunity to probably beat that record. But, you know, that night just didn't feel like it should have been a night unless, you know, they came back or something.
Damian Lillard joining us. Look, you're not going to make it about you. That's not your deal. But there is no denying that this team is your team. You set the tone. You set the example for everybody else. So how do you approach that role? And then what kind of things have you learned along the way about being a leader?
I think just as being a leader, you got to put the team first. You got to be willing to put other people's feelings and other people's, successes in front of yours at times where you got to want it bad for other guys, so they'll fight harder for you. But I think the biggest thing I've learned about being a leader is there's going to be a lot of moments where you got to do the unpopular thing, maybe to you, where you got to do something that might make other people uncomfortable, or you got to do something to make other people comfortable that might make you uncomfortable. So I've been in those situations, but that's probably the biggest thing that I've learned about being a leader.
You know, Damian, there was a point last month where there was a report that you had a meeting with team owner Paul Allen to discuss the direction of the franchise. I'm not going to ask you about the details of the conversation, but what was the thinking behind that meeting? And then how did you feel coming out of it?
The point of it was only to see what direction it was going in. I think, you know, people get so caught up in who the top teams are and all that stuff that sometimes we even look at them that way instead of, you know, really attacking how we could become one of them. And I just, you know, the meeting was only about how can we move in that direction. And I left the meeting feeling fine. You know, I just asked some questions. And, you know, I always tell people I want to be the best Blazer ever. I want to win a championship, and I want to do it here. So, you know, why not open up that communication to see what needs to happen for us to do it?
Talking to Damian Lillard for a few more moments. You're headed to your third All-Star game. You're having a big, big season. I laid the stats out. What does that honor mean to you this year?
It means a lot because my first two times I made it, I was on a veteran team. You know, it was really a product of our success as a team. And it is this year, too, but I feel like I really had to go get it. You know, I had to really impact games and really impact the team for us to be at a level where I could get the nod.
Damian Lillard, my guest. Let me ask you something. Let's go back. I mean, before all the 50-point games, before all the All-Star appearances, before any of this, when you were in high school, you saw a Babe sweatshirt that you wanted to buy. What do you remember about that sweatshirt and how much it cost?
I don't remember how much it cost, but I remember I saw Lil Wayne wearing it. And that was like the first time I had ever really like got into Babe. It was like a purple hoodie. Had the gorillas all over it. It was like real baggy, but it was like it was swaggy. Me and all my friends were like, yeah, Wayne always wearing the Bape, and he had the Bape shoes and the Bape jeans and all that stuff. So it was kind of a big deal. And from that point on, you know, I think I always had a level of interest in Bape.
Right, to that point, now you fast forward to today. Now you've got a limited edition of the Adidas Dame 4. It's a collaboration with Bape. First of all, how did the collaboration come about? Is it because of what we're talking about right here? And then to see this thing play out in real time after you came up the way you did and just told that story you just told, what's that collaboration like for you?
I mean, it's pretty cool, especially coming from where it came from. But it's exactly what I usually do, where a lot of things that I have interest in are stuff from my childhood, or I'm trying to tell a story, and it comes full circle, and that's just another one of those things.
Damon, one more of one of those things. Now, you are on Ep 6 of our podcast back on October 3rd. Your album had just come out 3 days later and hit the emerging mm-hmm. artist charts. Now you're debuting at number 32 on Billboard's Emerging Artist chart on the strength of your sophomore studio album, Confirmed, which was released on October 6th. What was that experience like?
The experience actually recording the album was really cool. It was different from what I did the first time because I had a lot more promotion. I did a press run in New York. I did a lot more to, I guess, give it legs even when the season started. So where it is now, it's pretty cool. You know, I'm out here playing basketball and doing the NBA stuff, and my music is still moving. So, you know, I don't know too many people that have accomplished it, but I feel pretty good about the fact that I have.
What is that, Damon? Is that time management? Is that talent? Is that all the above? How can you manage these things? I would never say, yeah, but you're supposed to do this, because very clearly you are excelling at a very high rate in a number of different things. What's the secret to that, the key to that for you?
I think it's time management. Like you said, I'm not, you know, going to the studio during the season and writing a bunch of music and listening to beats and being up late and all that. So I'm able to function at a high level as an athlete because during the season I do all the things I need to be doing to make that happen. In the summer I have a lot of time off, a lot of downtime, so that's the time I use to make a lot of music. I'm listening to beats, I'm writing stuff, I'm listening to other people's music, so I'm able to put out quality music. You know, and any other thing, I might do a show. You know, I did 2 shows last summer, so I think it's time management, just making sure first things come first, but, you know, also having that balance of doing other things that I like to do.
The beef being between Matt in L.A. and Orion in Waterford. Now, I missed that call yesterday, but apparently the call yesterday was not that different from the call that Orion made about a week before.
Have a take, Matt. Don't suck, Matt. Stop breaking the rules. Or better yet, dude, just go away. Leave us all alone. Find a new show, because, bro, nobody likes you.
So apparently there was more of the same yesterday. So it's only fair. You know, Matt's not going to back down from a fight. And it's only fair that Matt gets to respond. Equal time for everybody, right? So no matter how little you think of him, he does deserve equal time after this guy came at him again yesterday. So let me go to Matt in L.A., and let's take care of this. Matt, nice to have you back. What's up?
Snaglito, thanks for the vine. Hey, congrats on a well-deserved 3-day weekend, pimp. But enough of the pleasantries, Roni. I'm not here for Olympic talk or NBA talk. I'm here for that unfinished business, namely this scumbucket star child from some speed freak outpost called Waterford? Yeah, I know, Jim. I never heard of this hillbilly hideaway either till this weak sauce spreading, no-take spewing, carnival-employed, candy-apple-dipping, candy-ass named Orion started calling out your boy Matt in L.A. with his elementary brand of slap that isn't even smack. Hey, yo, Orion. That whack talk may be appropriate in your 8,000-plus township, but it don't fly in the jungle. I got major league takes for the millions watching and listening, son. You barely can speak, much less speak for this great nation of America, you rolling-eye little nitwit. And plus, Waterford versus L.A.? Waterford couldn't even qualify for single-A rookie league representation, son. I will bitch smack you backhanded like I was Morris Day, you invertebrate invalid inbred. Stay out my business.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
That's too much. Trayvon Blewett is my guest. Trayvon, so good to have you on. How are you? What's up?
Hey, I'm good. How's everything going?
Everything's great. It's good to hear your voice on Saturday. Let me start right there. You beat Creighton in their place 72-71. I start there because you win on a pair of free throws from Quentin Gooden with less than a second left. So what's going through your mind when he goes to the line needing to make one to tie it and two to take the lead?
I mean, honestly, I was confident the whole time. I mean, we work on free throws every day in practice, and, you know, he's one of the guys that usually only miss one, you know, or not at all. So when he went to the line, I knew that he was, you know, at least going to give us one. And when he hit the first one, it was pretty much evident to me that he was going to hit the second one.
You know, and you guys have had so much success in close games. I mean, that win came after two straight overtime wins. In fact, over the course of the season, you're 9-0 in games decided by 6 points or fewer. So how do you explain the fact that this team is so tough in pressure situations?
You know, I think, for one, we work on it in practice, you know, a lot, just being put in game-time situations where we're up one or down two. I think that's one thing. And then we just got a group of tough guys, you know, mentally tough guys that are locked in at the right time, you know, that stay composed and that stay poised in those tough situations. And I think that's how we get through it.
You know, I'm looking at this, and you went to the Elite Eight last season, of course, and now you followed that up by having a monster year. You're currently ranked number four in the country. I mean, Xavier basketball has always been good, but how much pride do you personally take in the fact that it's taken it to another level in the time that you've been there?
I just want to, you know, try to put them on the map and, you know, let everybody know that, you know, we're not just, you know, a team that makes the tournament every year. You know, we're a full-force team. You know, always top in the country, and I just feel like, you know, it's time to get that respect. And you know, so far this year, we've been playing great as a unit, and we've been letting our game do the talk, and so far it's been doing well for us.
Trayvon Blewett joining us. You know, in terms of helping put them on the map or taking them to the next level, you pretty much could have done that anywhere. When you were being recruited at a Park Tudor High School in Indianapolis, you had offers from all over the country. So what was it about Xavier that made you feel like that was the place for you?
I think the biggest thing was the relationship that I had built with the coaches. I really started communicating with them around ninth grade, and, you know, pretty much we kept a stable relationship since then. I took a couple visits, and, you know, they just, you know, were talking to me and told me how they saw me in their program, and it seemed like a good fit along with the move to the Big East. I felt like, you know, that it was the best situation for me.
Let me take you one step further on that, because Chris Mack is one of my favorite interviews in college basketball, because as good of a coach as he is, there are so many other parts to him as a person. What's he been like to play for?
He's been great. I mean, you know, he gives you, you know, the freedom as long as you're willing to play hard and play the right way. You know, he does a good job of getting guys that, you know, love to play basketball, that just love to compete. And, you know, we built a great culture, a great competitive culture. And I felt like that's done as well on the court. And, you know, we owe it to him, you know, just being able to instill confidence in us and, you know, letting us go. I feel like, you know, he's the reason why we're here.
Now listen, you had the opportunity to enter the NBA after last season. So how'd you go about evaluating that decision, and what brought you back to school?
You know, so I worked out for a few teams, which went well. You know, they had some things to say, and ultimately I just feel like, you know, my decision was to come back to school to win a national championship. I mean, last year, like you mentioned, we made it to the Elite Eight, and, you know, just to get a taste of, you know, of how it is and getting so close to the Final Four, that's something that I really wanted and that I've been wanting before I even came to college. So, you know, just to try to put myself in a position to make it to the Final Four and do something and make school history for Xavier, the first time ever.
Trayvon Blewett joining us. Now, over the course of your time at that school, you have completely reshaped your body. You've lost 25 pounds. So what was your process? How did you go about doing that? And then what kind of an impact has that had on your game?
I mean, I think after freshman year, I kind of, you know, met with a couple of dietitians, and, you know, they got me right on the right things to eat, how many meals to eat a day, and when to really not eat. And so I think the biggest thing for me was not eating after 9, 10 o'clock. And I feel like that, once I started doing that, I lost about 10 pounds over the course of, you know, a month or two, and along with a lot of conditioning. I feel like that's worked a lot for me. It's just made me a lot mobile, you know, a lot more athletic, being able to guard a little better and, you know, being able to get to my spots on offense.
You know, you're going to go down, obviously, as one of the greats ever to play at that program. You hit the 2,000-point mark, which is a huge milestone, but that doesn't mean that it hasn't been without challenges. As an example, during your sophomore season, you went into a bit of a slump, something which you've described as one of the low moments of your career. Can you take me back? What do you remember about that time, and then how did you work your way out of it?
I think back at that time, it was just I was, you know, scoring just like 8-9 points for like 4, 5, 6 games, and it took me like 12 shots to get those. And I mean, that was kind of tough for me just because I was just so used to being able to score the ball at an efficient level without really any problems. And that kind of hit me right there. That was like, you know, you got to be in the gym more. You got to work out. Everything isn't just given to you. And, you know, from that moment, I just, you know, stayed in the gym, you know, made sure I always got, you know, tons of shots up before and after practice. And, you know, eventually I ripped that out and the muscle memory came into play. And, you know, that's where I got out of it.
It paid off. You scored your 2,000th career point. That puts you up there with guys like David West, Tyrone Hill in school history. I mean, look, the season's not over. Your career at Xavier is not over. I know you've got big goals still ahead of you, but that's a huge milestone. What's that number mean to you, and what's that milestone represent?
It means a lot just to be one of few in the program to be able to reach 2,000 points. I mean, it's a great feeling. It's a real feeling. And then, I mean, just, you know, hopefully, you know, it just means that I'm up there with elite company for, you know, the people that have impacted the program, you know, like David West, Tyrone Hill, Byron Larkin. I mean, it's just something that I'm always going to remember to be able to, you know, be able to have 2,000 points along with the team accolades that I've had over the 4 years.
Xavier guard, Trayvon Blewett, my guest. Hey, before you go, I need you to clear something up. There's a legend that's grown up around this team, and it's in part due to the fact that there's a rumor that one of your teammates showed up back in 2014 with a couple of pairs of Patrick Ewing shoes. Now, dude, part of me wants to say there's no way that's true. There's no way, because I didn't even know they made Ewings anymore. Is it true? And if so, I mean, I hate to give up one of your guys, but who was it and what did you make of the kicks?
You know, I didn't even know they made Ewings at all. And that was the first time that I've seen something like that. And, you know, my the teammate was Sean O'Mara. You know, he got like a size 17 foot. So when I saw it, I was just like, wow. I was in awe. And, I mean, he had them in different flavors, too. I mean, he had them in white and black, black and white. I mean, he had the whole thing. And, you know, after we clowned him for it, he never pulled him out the closet. I don't even know if he has them anymore. But, you know, those were a sight to see.
Daily Jungle now in the can, Ep 24 of the Jim Rome Podcast with Molly Bloom should be ready for your ride home. Trust the podcast and then check back here for more tomorrow. I will catch you then. I'm out.